Something is stirring. Maybe you've felt it. We are reckoning with the reality of injustice and binary thinking that feeds the political machine. Humanity is in the midst of a heartbreaking and painful paradigm shift. That is a good thing. My name is Lola Wright, and this is Find Your Fierce and Loving. This podcast is intended to help you disrupt, untangle, and free your mind of personal and collective agreements, patterns, and beliefs that are holding you back and weighing you down. We desperately need your fierce and loving purpose now more than ever. All right, I'm so excited to have this brilliant being with me today on Find Your Fierce and Loving. His name is Joel L. Daniels, also known as Joel Leon. He is a Bronx born and raised performer, father, author, and storyteller who writes and tells stories for Black people. His TED Talk on healthy co-parenting has been viewed over 1.5 million times. He's worked with the Gates Foundation, HBO, Nike, Twitter, and The Today Show, and has been featured in Ebony, The Independent, Newsweek, Medium, BBC News, Sirius XM, Forbes, The Huffington Post, Blavity, and others. He is a Creative Collective NYC Creative Class alumni, winner of the BCA Bronx Recognizes Its Own Award in Poetry, and author of Book About Things I Will Tell My Daughter and God Wears Do-Rags Too. He is repped by Folio Literary. I have been following him for a few years on Instagram, and I am like, as I told him earlier, I'm sort of fangirling over here. It's probably one of the great sources of inspiration for me on Twitter and on Instagram on a daily basis. So, Joel, I said to you, I feel this sort of like buzzing in my body. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for that beautiful, beautiful reading of my bio. It feels way too long when you're reading it out loud. Like, I need to cut this.
In comparison, it's short. I will tell you, sometimes I'm like, oh, dear God. Okay, here we go.
It's not even over yet. But no, thank you so much for the time and space and for that intro. I am very much excited to be here and sharing space with you today. So thank you for this, for sure.
So a few things that come to mind. You put out a tweet and a post today about abundance. And it was basically a declaration like, you are abundant and you are prosperous.
Yeah.
And ironically, I had a post that came out very shortly thereafter. And it was about a very similar concept around abundance and prosperity. And prosperity of spirit, the truth of who you are, you know,
right.
not just measured by your stuff. When I saw that, I was like, oh, this is an example of one mind. And that's sort of an old school metaphysical term, like we are intrinsically connected. Nothing is happening in isolation. And so there's this old excerpt from this spiritual philosopher named Ernest Holmes. And he says, there's only one life. That life is God's life. That life is perfect. That life is my life now. And that for me has always been like a source of strength. Like if there's only one life,
I love that.
Then that means nothing and no one is in truth opposing me. And I bring that up because we're living in a time, especially with the state of media, where there's a lot fueled by believing in opposition. And I think one of the things that you do so beautifully is offer this affirmative voice of what I would call truth, and I would call it like radical truth, with a fair amount of nuance, which, by the way, is like next to impossible to do on social media.
It is very difficult.
And offering a cultural critique at the same time without adding to the drama. I'm like, that is like threading a needle. Radical truth, nuance, cultural critique, and transcending drama. I'm like, let me take a class with this man.
Thank you for that, because it's great when you, I mean, one mind, right? It's great when you encounter people who get it. For me, it's been, but it's also been a process, you know? And I think this process is very familiar to a person such as yourself, Lola, who I think has been doing the work. For me, like when I think about prosperity, I only think of it with regards to spiritual well-being and spiritual wealth, you know? And a lot of that for me is also reframing the language, because there's a general connotation we have when we use words like prosperity and abundance. It generally comes back to how many things I can accumulate, or what I've accumulated, or what my financial success and stability looks like. And for me, it's always wanting to create space for a multitude of conversations to live within each other while offering an opportunity for us to all kind of benefit from that experience or that affirmation, you know? Because at one point in time, it did feel like, you know, it felt like affirmations were kind of corny for me specifically.
I get it.
Right. And not even the idea that it doesn't benefit people. But for me, it was kind of always in the back of my mind, like, are people thinking like this dude's a cornball? Because I think, and again, I feel like I can speak for the both of us here, because we both have been following each other for a similar period of time. It was like, it became a cool thing to like have affirmations. And I don't think, as much as people want to kind of lambast it, I think the idea remains like having affirmations be popular is not a bad thing. I don't think there can ever be a bad or too much of people kind of sharing that truth with the world. And for me, it was like, I wanted to share what I was experiencing and what I was learning, and sharing it and using, I started utilizing Twitter as the platform to do that. Where it was just me kind of putting these ideas I was having, ideas that were very much centered around mindfulness, around the Buddhist practice.
And how did you get oriented with that?
I feel like I was fucking up, and I needed some guidance, honestly. You know, like, I was in a relationship at the time that I was just struggling to show up and find myself in. And honestly, and I mentioned this in a recent podcast, there was this book, and I'm going to look it up right now. But it was a book that Ayana Von Zandt wrote for Black men.
I love her. She and I are trained in the same tradition.
The Spirit of a Man. It's a book I found when I was living in Atlanta, and it was just like it was like in a used book pile or whatever. And I picked it up, and that book started the journey for me, because Ayana was talking about words like surrender, and surrender, as biblical as it is for her, she was talking to the experience of the Black man. Granted, the book is a little dated, to be honest. It's like early 90s, so some of the language is like a little patriarchal. But like, I was able to glean from that what I needed to. And then I started just looking for different things that were speaking to what I was experiencing. So I started reading some Eckhart Tolle, and I started reading some Gary Zukav, and then Dharma Seed. DharmaSeed.org became really the place where I would just go and listen to Dharma talks every day.
That's cool.
Because I needed it. I was using it as fuel. So like when we think of like the Tara Brocks of the world and the Sharon Salzbergs, for me, that became the place where I could like really hear what I was feeling and have it be vocalized. But what I was seeing was that I didn't feel like I saw anybody from my perspective coming from where I came from. Like, you know, I was born and raised in the Bronx. Like I was born in the hood, like the hood, and hadn't really seen anybody who was speaking to this space in a way that felt honest and true for me. So I just started speaking it on my own terms, you know?
I think the voice that you offer is so essential, and I get so excited when I hear it coming forward, because it is so important to understand the ways that our personal journey, inquiry, transformation is intrinsically connected to our collective awakening. And, you know, the movement out of which I come is largely consumed historically by white consumers that don't necessarily, by virtue of privilege and position and power in this society, realize that our navel gazing is insufficient. And in fact, our navel gazing is part of the problem. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. This is what I'm saying. Like the voices that are emerging around personal transformation and a collective awakening are so important, because personal transformation is intended to be in service of collective awakening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love how you frame that. And to your point, you know, it's it begets the question, like an awakening for whom, you know, like who is this awakening at a certain point in time. And so for me, what I realized was like, as a cis hetero Black man who has privilege in that regard, like I'm able-bodied, I'm a man still, regardless, I'm brown skin. So like there are things, right, that allow me to show up in spaces that I could recognize. But for me, the ideal has always been getting a platform so that I can elevate the conversation and also potentially platform other voices that have been doing the work. You know, I've been doing the work way before I got here, because my intention was never to be a person who helped kind of steer the conversation of personal transformation per se. It was like, these are my thoughts. Like, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm feeling. And there's a platform for me to share it, and started to see that there were other people who were gravitating towards, who were looking for answers, but also, to your point earlier, like nuance, because I think all of this is nuance. Like, none of this shit is black and white. Like, when I think about personal transformation, for me, it was like recognizing my privilege again as a cis hetero Black man, but then also trying to see how I could potentially learn through trial and error. Like, I was saying things that I was experiencing in hopes that I could explain it in a way that felt relative to the community. Because, like, I'm reading the books and I'm like, again, no one is coming from this vantage point. And not even seeing it as like seeing it as an opportunity, but less of an opportunity with the table stakes of growing my platform, but more like an opportunity for our own personal growth and well-being. Like, we don't have the language. I didn't have the language growing up, but now I can give this language to my nephew. So when my nephew, when he was 16 at the time, when we would have a conversation about, yo, unk, how did you learn how to be quiet? You know, like, no, there was no wherewithal, no awareness to that, but he has that language because I fueled him with it, so we can talk about what it means to be kind versus nice and what it actually means to live in your truth. Because I spent a lot of times trying to appease other people who expected me to be a certain kind of Black man in order to either fulfill their appetite for what they deemed to be an appropriate masculine representation of Blackness or whatever the case might be. And it took me a long ass time to get to a place of like, this is who I am. This is how I show up. And hopes that it would allow others to feel like they could do the same for themselves, you know?
What is the distinction between kind and nice for you?
For me, kind is the energy, you know? I think nice is the way in which we do things. Like, you can do nice things for people, which is cool. Like, I love when people do nice things for me. I remember very clearly I liked being a nice guy. It's a thing. It's a trope that men love to lean into when they're hoping to get their way to a certain extent. But what I realized as I got older was that kind was a more generous and more understanding way of walking in the world. And again, kindness is really, for me, it was the embodiment of the person. You know, nicety or niceties were the thing that you get to do, but kindness, you're doing things through kindness, it's like the level up. It's very much to me similar in how I view empathy and compassion now. And some of that I kind of gleaned from Sharon Salzberg, where it's like, for me, empathy at this point are table stakes. Like, being empathetic is important, but compassion is really the action that's connected to that empathy. So for me, kindness is very much in that same space. Like, we get to be kind, and that kindness, again, it reverberates. Niceties don't change the world. You know, I think kindness, that energy of kindness can, you know, if we're fortunate enough to be a part of it.
I recently did an Instagram live with my 21-year-old son.
We
talked about the murder of Dante Wright and, you know, what his experience is as a young Black man, as a young person consuming media, that's like, you know, how does it occur for him in a particular way? You know, it's interesting. My kids, my older kids, you know, they don't have the same attraction to social media. Like, I think they're sort of pretty fatigued by it. And I think they see the drama of it. So I'm curious for you, like, how do you navigate that in your own being, like staying informed, staying relevant to the people who follow you, being a leader, adding your voice, and not just contributing something to get sort of engagement or the likes or the drama or the righteousness? How does that live for you?
I think some of that lives in the timing of it for me and like paying attention to where I am physically in my body. You know, like I don't tweet or share anything unless I feel compelled to do so. Prime example, what was I doing after we got the verdict for Derek Chauvin? Yeah. I was coming from a photo shoot, and I was walking in the street, and this black man, we had all been paying attention to Twitter, waiting for paid from the verdict, and there was this black man driving in his truck, and I just heard him say, "Guilty, guilty!" Like he got stuck in traffic, and he was just shouting it the entire time, and for me, that inspired me to say something, right? So for me, it's always been about paying attention to my feelings while also trying to recognize the energy of the community. Not everyone's going to feel the same. It's also knowing when to tune out. And then also when we talk about paying attention to the community, knowing who, if someone is saying the thing that maybe I want to say, let me let that voice do that work. You know? Like for me, that's also just as important. Like, I don't need to be the voice. There's so many other voices. And I would love for us all as a community to kind of be able to do that, like gauging, do I need to show up in this space, in this moment in time, or am I just filling a void that I have or feel? And I can recognize when I've done that before, not necessarily when it comes to our loss and our grief and our trauma, but more like, I need to say something now on social because I haven't said anything in a day, as opposed to being able to sit back, relinquish ego in that space and recenter, recalibrate and say, how do I need to show up for myself today? Because what generally happens is when I redirect that energy towards how do I need to show up for myself, I then generally wind up showing up in ways that feel more proficient and sufficient for me and I think the community. As opposed to looking to fill a gap that's missing in my own spirit and like what is needed. Because I feel like very much, and I think you can relate to this, when we're sharing or speaking to whatever is happening, especially when we're talking about the trauma that can sometimes take over social. When we take a step back and look at what it is we're being called to do or not do, for me, that's the energy that shows up most effectively, because then I'm just speaking from a place that's bigger than me. And like, it's kind of, I'm tapping into the truth. I'm tapping into the source as opposed to looking for something that's going to help me get to that source, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what I keep hearing as you're speaking is the distinction between competition and creation. Mm. You know, and this idea like creation comes from within and it's not something that needs to be contrived and it moves at its own cadence and flow and pace. And actually, you can trust it very deeply when you rest in it. Competition is rooted in scarcity, you know, the way we understand it in our culture. And so it's really about, okay, I got to kill something off so that I can get there before the next, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And like racing each other for no apparent reason and like not even really being sure of a destination, which for me, the more I've actually relinquished the idea of a destination, the more freer I've become. You know, like there were so many, like there were things, and you know this, right? Like once I do this TED talk, then once I get there, then once I work with this person, then, and there's always another then. You know, there's always some other, you know, proverbial mountain that we need to climb for our own well-being, and then we can justify it. But at the end of the day, the most liberated I feel is when I'm just in flow and doing the work And, you know, and like there's a difference, like tapping into the source feels different. I feel that way generally, like when I'm on stage, like when I'm like, if I'm rapping, if I'm performing, there's a level of connectivity to the source that is very much inherent, which is why I miss performing in front of people. So, you know, we did some virtual shows, myself and my best friend, Arthur Lewis, and those shows just weren't the same because there was no audience. We were doing like virtual performances for people that weren't there. And like, the connection is different because there's an energy. Like when you say one mind, I get excited because essentially that's what we're doing. You know, like we're all connected, which is why I also kind of in a separate tangent, but I don't feel a type of way if I see an idea that I've had being shared. Because to me, it's like we're one mind, like, and no idea is new, you know? So like, who am I to think that this thing that I've written or this thing that I've said or this idea that I've had hasn't been adopted by somebody else? You know, like the other day, I coined the phrase Afro-normalism because
I saw that. Yeah.
You know, and shout out to Ebony Janice, because Ebony Janice is very much like that's the homie. And she's very big on citing these like our work, right? Like you don't have to be from an institution in order to cite your work or your work. But Afro-normalism is not new. It's the idea of how do we talk about the mundane experiences, the boring experiences of Black life in a way that feels joyful and good to us, like Black people making tea, Black people walking, Black people parenting. Like, how do we tell those stories and what space do those stories get to live in? Where for so long, like as a poet, I used to feel like I had to write about, you can open that up, I had to write about trauma, or I had to write about hardship, or write about Black love. And like, there was a way that you had to perform spoken word pieces in order to
trauma porn,
you know, all of that. And for me, it was like, I love the poems I used to love the most were like, if I was reading Ginsberg, or if I was reading Bukowski and he was talking about getting the mail or watching TV, like shit that I was like, I don't see Black folks getting to talk about that, or we feel limited, or we're being limited to certain stories. And so for me, it became that, like, how do we kind of create, and it goes back to a point I brought up earlier, like, how do we get to recreate language and reframe language that feels suitable for us in the moment, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I struggle with because I have an unwillingness to use these platforms to use trauma as entertainment, which I think is in large part what people do. And I think especially people who are just waking up to the in quote unquote injustices of the United States of America. It's like now it's like, you know, we talk about sort of performative activism, but it's like it's more subtle than even that. It's like, you know, this idea of like, I gotta hurry up and say the thing so that everybody knows that like I'm tracking on this conversation. And it's like, oh, I have an experience. I have an aversion in my body to that, such that I end up not wanting to say anything because I'm like, I don't even want to participate in that.
I don't want to be seen as a part of this problem. And like wanting to get the sound bite out the quickest, you know? I think a prime example of that, DMX. We were talking about DMX's death before it actually happened, you know, because, and I think some of that potentially, of course, was this idea of wanting to get the news out first. I think some of it was just because there were so many varying sources coming around, and collectively as a community, and it's something I shared recently, like we mourned together. You know, like the Black community grieves together, we hurt together. So one death feels like a million, you know, one loss feels like a thousand. Like it's compounded because, again, to your point, this one mind.
Well, and also the distinction between individualism and communal existence.
Yes, yes. And how that community, for me, I've really been trying to push this idea of community as life-saving, because especially now when we look at the pandemic, where it's been so hard to create community virtually for a lot of people, because for some people that's not their expertise. Like there's so many layers and nuance, right, to the experience and the experiences we're having, especially now, because
we're trying to learn how to navigate these new territories. Like, this pandemic is still new. Like, a year's not a long time. You know, a lot happens in a year. And so what I've been trying to preach for a lot of us is that grace and forgiveness and kindness that is required. And when we're doing that, I think that also allows us to be mindful of, again, to your point, am I doing this? Am I trying to lean into the trauma for my own, for conversation's sake and for points? Or is there a real call here for me to show up in this space? And I think we miss the boat when we keep looking at ourselves as opposed to what does the community need? Because honestly, if I'm fulfilling the needs of the community, I'm generally more than likely going to be fulfilling the needs of myself. If I'm tapped in and if I'm doing the work.
You want to be more alive. You want to unleash your inherent love and goodness, liberate yourself, and free humanity from the oppressive systems and structures we have created. We are here to support you in finding your fierce and loving life. Join us in Our Circle. This is an affirming and radical space that will gather weekly, on demand, or live, whatever works best for your life. For more information on how you can engage in Our Circle, visit lolawright.com/our-circle. I'd love to have you with us. So the end of your TED Talk, you landed on ashe, and you know, that is a Yoruba word, and it is, you know, in the Western world and in the United States of America, we're most familiar with amen, and the English translation of the word amen is "and so it is," and we could say the Yoruba equivalent of that is ashe. And that word actually has an even more potent articulation than amen, because what it essentially means is this word creates. It is a creative capacity in and of itself. And so I love to break stuff down, because I think sometimes people use words because it's sort of like hot, but we don't always know what they mean. And I just had such appreciation for you using that word. I have to be mindful using it as a white woman, because it's very easy to have white people appropriate practices, especially in the spiritual space. But I would love to hear from you why it was important that you close with that, and or what does that word mean for you uniquely?
You know, a few things. Me saying ashe at the end of that talk, it was also for me the same reason why I wore a blue bandana in my breast pocket during the talk. You know, like, I was very intentional towards the end of that talk to shout out, I'm going to bounce around a little bit, but like, call and response, right? Very much ancestral, very much a part of the hip hop culture I grew up in. But also, like, when we look at enslaved peoples and we look at the continent, and the diaspora that is Africa and the Caribbean as well, it is very much in this the chanting of names and name calling. And so for me, when I'm shouting out those Black men whom I love, is very much rooted in that. You know, ashe is very much rooted in that. The bandana, which was for me a tribute to Nipsey Hussle, a Black man who lost to the struggle, who was murdered. It, for me, it was very much a calling, an ancestral calling, and utilizing a very white space, which is TED, in order to do that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's something I've said from early on, like, you know, pardon the language, but like, I want to take my niggas with me, like wherever I go. Like, I take the Bronx with me wherever I go. And so it's always imperative for me to kind of show up in spaces that are generally not created for my experience, and bringing my experience into those spaces as a form of disruption and also as a form of healing, to like illuminate, highlight, and showcase that we get to be here too. We're supposed to be here too. We get to hold space here too. We get to tell our stories here too, right? You know, and utilizing language that is speaking to that experience to me, so that if when my daughter West or my other daughter Lila sees it, they know, like, their father was speaking from a place that is true to him and true to them as well. You know what I'm saying? So like they feel like they are a part of it. Because for me, that's always the underlying thing. Like, how do we make the community feel like they're supposed to be here and welcomed in the space at times when we often aren't, you know?
Again, like living from the inside out rather than having the environment dictate who you're going to be. I mean, it's so funny because halfway through that talk, I was like, who is this talk for? Like, that was like the literal question. I kept being like, huh, this man is a brilliant man. Who is this talk for? Because I know those rooms, yeah. You know what yeah. I mean? And then like almost seconds later, you started calling out who I imagined were people that were really, you know, crucial to you, that you held high or hold high. And you know, as you wrapped up, I'm like, oh, he created an altar up here. That's really what he did. This was an altar, you know, it's beautiful.
One of the names I mentioned, Kareem was from around my way. Kareem died of a heart attack, maybe a few years after his mother had passed away. And so I grew up with Kareem, you know, and Kareem was a father, you know, and I went to school with Kareem, you know? And so for me, it was like, when I think about how many times the talk has been viewed, I think about how many times people have heard the name Kareem. You know, for me, that to me is like what's most important. Like people talk about the co-parenting and that's cool. You know, like it was hard getting to a place where both Lila's mother and I could coexist in like a friendly, loving space. But for me, that talk was an opportunity to bring Blackness into the space and bring the Bronx into the space. Like it could have been a talk on art. It could have been a talk about anything. It was just more about bringing those names and bringing the spirit of those names into those spaces. Those the brothers that I grew up around, the brothers that I love, the brothers that I uphold, to your point, in a certain light. Like that was the most important part of it for me.
So I'll just wrap with this. What are you most excited about? I mean, I know it's sort of a weird time, right? It's like, I'm with you with the, like, I too, I'm like the best place for me is a microphone, a stage, a room full of people and a band up on that stage. Like that's
absolutely like, listen, right? I like you do it. And like, I appreciate that about you. There's such a vitality in how you show up that I think is encouraging, because I also feel like so many of us as light givers, we tend to, for whatever reason, tend to think, and you brought this up already, we tend to think that we are in a silo of this work when it's like, there's so many of us doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm the thing I'm most excited about is my eldest daughter, Lila, being here in New York for the summer. That is the thing I'm probably most excited about right now. But, you know, like, you know, the working on the essay collection, which is great, you know, having conversations with wonderful humans such as yourself. Like, those are the things I tend to get most excited about. But for right now, really, it's the potential for the essay collection. I think I've never been the person to be like, my work is needed. But I'm finally at the place of, like, the work that I'm doing, with, as far as the essays are concerned. Like, I'm talking about body image, right? Like, my body image as a Black father. And, like, I don't, outside of, like, when I think of the work that Keith Lehman did for Heavy, like Heavy to me was like one of the most beautifully written books that I've seen by anybody, Black man, woman, non-binary person. But the way he talked about his weight for me was inspiring, because Black men generally don't talk about their bodies unless their bodies are the ideal body, right? And my body is is not the ideal at all, at least for me. And so wanting to be able to talk about that, talking about porn addiction, talking about like there's so many things that I wanted to talk to and through for the essay collection that I felt really happy about, that I feel like is going to hopefully land the way in which I want it to. But then also that coupled with my daughter being here this summer, that's like, those are the most exciting things for me right now.
One of the favorite quotations that I reference is from Eckhart Tolle, and he says, one of the greatest sources of grace known to humankind is acceptance of the unacceptable. Mm. And, you know, I think it's like applicable even to one's body. It's like, can I accept the unacceptability of my body?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. That to me is through and through that's so powerful, because there's so much that we've deemed to be unacceptable. And I think also unfortunately, I don't necessarily even think we've deemed that. We've been taught that it's unacceptable, and so we've adopted it as.
Yes.
And, you know, and again, you do this work. It's something I encourage us all to do, is just to investigate more what the truth is and who gave this to us as a truth. Do I need to keep this as a truth for my personal development? Not, you know, because if I'm doing that, then I'm feeding the community. You know, I can't speak for the community. That's not my job. My job is to translate what I'm getting from the source in a way that feels palatable to the community, and the community can take from that if they want to, but I can't speak for the community, which is also why, like, I want us to have more conversations about cancel culture, and like, because we have cancel culture, but we're not talking enough about restorative justice. Like,
yes,
you know, like they live in tandem, but we're not getting the second half of the conversation. So for me, again, when I talk about speaking for the community, there's certain things that I think feel black and white, but a lot of it is gray. So I want to talk about the gray, you know?
My recommendation is give yourself the gift of being with this beautiful being, Joel Leon, by following him on Twitter and on Instagram. His handle is I am Joel Leon. How else can people like engage with your work these days? I know you have two books out. We'll have those in the show notes. If people are like, I want more. I mean, that's sort of the way we roll. It's like, give me more. You know, how can they get more?
That'll be great. I mean, if people want more, that's awesome. The Instagram is always going to be the best place, because I have my weekly series with Ebony.com, Sunday Manifest. So that they share that on their channel. I post about it generally every week that it goes up on each Sunday. The link in my bio is always going to be probably the most updated information. If that's going to be my website, if that's going to be a show or like a podcast, right, or whatever the case is, like the link in the bio is going to take you everywhere you need to go and everywhere hopefully you want to be. And then, like, you know, the Twitter, Joel, aka MAG, that used to be my rap name, Mag, for those who are wondering, shorthand for MacGyver, because MacGyver, if you gave him anything, he can make something happen. So that's what I felt like.
I love that. Well, Joel, I speak so many blessings on your work. I'm grateful for it in my life. I affirm, I know, I claim, I demand. You know, the word ask in its Latin root actually means to demand. We relate to the word ask like, hopefully something will happen over here. But it's like, no, speak that thing. Say that thing.
That's beautiful to know, actually. That's awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah. So many blessings on your work. Thank you for your willingness to hang with me. And I know that when we are back open for real, I would love to have you on a stage in Chicago.
Yeah, I would absolutely be there. Absolutely.
If you enjoyed this show and would like to receive new episodes as they're published, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and consider leaving a review in Apple Podcasts. Your review helps others find this show. You can follow me at Lola P. Wright on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and learn more about my work at lolawright.com. This episode was produced by Quinn Rose, with theme music from independent music producer Trey Royal.
And so, like, when we talk about that nuance, I think some of that.
Are you living in an experience of like all your worlds converging by virtue of young children and a pandemic and all the things?
Everything is happening right now, right now in this moment in general.
This is like the moment when we practice for, actually, right?
This is exactly why we do the work, so we can show up.
Is that West?
Yes, this is West. West is...
Hi, West.
West, do you want to say hi?